No one can play a game alone. One cannot be human by oneself. There is no selfhood where there is no community. We do not relate to others as the persons we are. We are who we are in relating to others. Simultaneously, the others with whom we are in relation are themselves in relation. We cannot relate to anyone who is not also relating to us. Our social existence has, therefore, an inescapably fluid character. This is not to say that we live in a fluid context, but that our lives are themselves fluid. As in the Zen image, we are not the stones over which the stream of the world flows. We are the stream itself. As we shall see, the ceaseless change does not mean discontinuity. Rather, the change is itself the very basis of our continuity as persons. Only that which can change can continue. This is the principle by which infinite players live. The fluidity of our social and therefore personal existence is a function of our essential freedom, the kind of freedom indicated in the formula, who must play, cannot play. Of course, as we have seen, finite games cannot have fluid boundaries, for if they do, it would be impossible to agree on winners. But finite games float, as it were, in the unconstrained choice each player makes in entering and continuing the play. Finite games sometimes appear, therefore, to have fixed points of social reference. Not only are there true and false ways of loving your country, for example, there is a positive requirement that you do so. It is this essential fluidity of our humanness that is irreconcilable with the seriousness of finite play. It is therefore this fluidity that presents us with an unavoidable challenge, how to contain the serious within the truly playful, that is, how to keep all our finite games in infinite play. This challenge is commonly misunderstood as the need to find room for playfulness within finite games. This is what was referred to above as playing at, or perhaps playing around, a kind of play that has no consequence. This is the sort of playfulness implied in an ordinary sense of such terms as entertainment, amusement, diversion, comic relief, recreation, relaxation. Inevitably, however, seriousness will creep back into this kind of play. The executive's vacation, like the football team's timeout, comes to be a device for refreshing the contestant for a higher level of competition. Even the open playfulness of children is exploited through organized athletic, artistic, and educational regimens as a means of preparing the young for serious adult competition. As an excerpt from Finite and Infinite Games by James Carse. This is Swan, and you are listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. It's been a while since I've released new content, so I'm glad to be here. I'm glad that you're listening, and I hope that you enjoy what I've been thinking about lately, which is late bloomers. Perhaps you are familiar with an article published in 2008 by Malcolm Gladwell called Late Bloomers. This was in the culture section of the October 20 issue of The New Yorker, and the subtitle is Why Do We Equate Genius with Precocity? All right, let's begin. Ben Fountain was an associate in the real estate practice at the Dallas offices of Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld, just a few years out of law school when he decided he wanted to write fiction. The only thing Fountain had ever published was a law review article. His literary training consisted of a handful of creating writing classes in college. He had tried to write when he came home at night from work, but he usually was too tired to do much. He decided to quit his job. "I was tremendously apprehensive," Fountain recalls. "I felt like I'd stepped off a cliff and I didn't know if the parachute was going to open. Nobody wants to waste their life, and I was doing well at the practice of law. I could have had a good career, and my parents were very proud of me. My dad was so proud of me. It was crazy." He began his new life on a February morning, a Monday. He sat down at his kitchen table at 7:30 a.m. He made a plan. Every day he would write until lunchtime. Then he would lie down on the floor for 20 minutes to rest his mind. Then he would return to work for a few more hours. He was a lawyer. He had discipline. I figured out very early on that if I didn't get my writing done, I felt terrible, so I always got my writing done. I treated it like a job. I did not procrastinate. His first story was about a stockbroker who uses inside information and crosses a moral line. It was 60 pages long and took him 3 months to write. When he finished that story, he went back to work and wrote another, and then another. In his first year, Fountain sold 2 stories. He gained confidence, he wrote a novel, he decided it wasn't very good, and he ended up putting it back in a drawer. Then came what he describes as his dark period, when he adjusted his expectations and started again. He got a short story published in Harper's. A New York literary agent saw it and signed him up. He put together a collection of short stories titled Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, and Echo, a HarperCollins imprint, published it. The reviews were sensational. The Times Book Review called it heartbreaking. He won the Hemingway Foundation Pen Book Review, Book Award. It won the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award. It was named a #1 book since Pick. It made major regional bestseller lists, was named one of the best books of the year by the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, and Kirkus Reviews, and drew comparisons to Graham Greene, Evelyn Waugh, Robert Stone, and John le Carré. Ben Fountain's rise sounds like a familiar story. The young man from provinces suddenly takes a literary world by storm. But Ben Fountain's success was far from sudden. He quit his job at Ack & Gump in 1988. For every story he published in those early years, he had at least 30 rejections. The novel that he put away in a drawer took him 4 years. The dark period lasted for the entire second half of the 1990s. His breakthrough with Brief Encounters came in 2006, 18 years after he first sat down to write at his kitchen table. The young writer from the provinces took the literary world by storm at the age of 48. Genius is a popular conception, is inextricably tied up with precocity. Precocity, yes. Doing something truly creative, we're inclined to think, requires the freshness and exuberance and energy of youth. Orson Welles made his masterpiece Citizen Kane at 25. Herman Melville wrote a book a year through his late 20s, culminating at age 32 with Moby Dick. A book a year. Whoa. Mozart wrote his breakthrough Piano Concerto #9 in E-flat major at the age of 21. In some creative forms, like lyrical poetry, the importance of precocity has hardened into an iron law. How old was T.S. Eliot when he wrote the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock? I grew old, I grow old. 23. Poets peak young, the creativity researcher James Kaufman maintains. Csikszentmihalyi, the author of Flow, agrees. The most creative lyric verse is believed to be that written by the young. According to Harvard psychologist Howard Gardner, the leading authority on creativity, lyric poetry is a domain where talent is discovered early, burns brightly, then peters out at an early age. A few years ago, an economist at the University of Chicago named David Gilson decided to find out whether this assumption about creativity was true. He looked through 47 major poetry anthologies published since 1980 and counted the poems that appeared most frequently. Some people, of course, would quarrel with the notion that literary merit can be quantified, but Galenson simply wanted to poll a broad cross-section of literary scholars about which poems they felt were most important in the American canon. The top 11 are, in order, T.S. Eliot's Prufrock, Robert Lowell's Skunk Hour, Robert Frost's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, William Carlos Williams, Red Wheelbarrow, Elizabeth Bishop's The Fish, Ezra Pound's The River Merchant's Wife, Sylvia Plath's Daddy, Pound's In a Station of the Metro, Frost's Mending Wall, Wallace Stevens, The Snowman, and Williams's The Dance. Those 11 were composed at the ages of 23, 41, 48, 40, 29, 30, 30, 28, 38, 42, and 59, respectively. There is no evidence, Gillinson concluded, for the notion that lyric poetry is a young person's game. Some poets do their best work at the beginning of their careers, others do their best work later. 42% of Frost's anthologized poems were written after the age of 50. For Williams, it's 44%. For Stevens, it's 49%. The same was true of film. Gillinson points out in his study Old Masters and Young Geniuses, the two life cycles of artistic creativity. Yes, there was Orson Welles peaking as a director at 25, but then there was Alfred Hitchcock, who made Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, To Catch a Thief, The Trouble with Harry, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and Psycho, one of the greatest runs by a director in history, between his 54th and 61st birthdays. Mark Twain published Adventures of Huckleberry Finn at 49, and Daniel Defoe wrote Robinson Crusoe at age 58. The examples that Gillinson could not get out of his head, however, were Picasso and Cézanne. He was an art lover, and he knew their stories well. Picasso was the incandescent prodigy. His career as a serious artist began with a masterpiece, Evocation, the Burial of Casagemas. Sorry, I can't pronounce these things. Evocation, the Burial of Casagemas, produced at age 20. In short order, he painted many of the greatest works of his career, including Les Demois d'Avignon at the age of 26. Picasso fit our usual ideas about genius perfectly. Cézanne didn't. If you go to the Cézanne room at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, the finest collection of Cézannes in the world, the array of masterpieces you'll find along the back wall were all painted at the end of his career. Gillinson did a simple economic analysis, tabulating the prices paid at auction for paintings by Picasso and Cézanne with the ages at which they were created those works. A painting done by Picasso in his mid-20s was worth, he found, an average of four times as much as a painting done in his 60s. For Cézanne, the opposite was true. The paintings he created in his mid-60s were valued 15 times as highly as the paintings he created as a young man. The freshness, exuberance, and energy of youth did little for Cézanne. He was a late bloomer, and for some reason, in our accounting of genius and creativity, we have forgotten to make sense of the Cézannes of this world. Of the world. The first day that Ben Fountain sat down to write at his kitchen table went well. He knew how the story about the stockbroker was supposed to start, but the second day he says he completely freaked out. He didn't know how to describe things. He felt as if he were back in first grade. He didn't have a fully formed vision waiting to be emptied onto the page. I had to create a mental image of a building, a room, a facade, haircut, clothes, just really basic things, he says. I realized I didn't have the faculty to put those into words. I started going out and buying visual dictionaries, architectural dictionaries, and going to school on those. He began to collect articles about things he was interested in, and before long he realized he had developed a fascination with Haiti. The Haiti file just kept getting bigger and bigger, Fountain says, and I thought, okay, here's my novel. For a month or two, I said I really don't need to go there. I can imagine everything. But after a couple months, I thought, yeah, I've got to go there. And so I went in April or May of 91. He spoke little French, let alone Haitian Creole. He had never been abroad, nor did he know anyone in Haiti. I got to the hotel, walked up the stairs, and there was this guy standing at the top of the stairs, Fountain recalls. He said, "My name is Pierre. You need a guide." I said, "You're sure as hell right I do." He was a very genuine person, and he realized pretty quickly I didn't want to go see see the girls. I didn't want drugs, and I didn't want any of that other stuff, Fountain went on. And then it was boom. I can take you there. I can take you to this person. Fountain was riveted by Haiti. It's like a laboratory almost, he says. Everything that's gone on the past 500 years, colonialism, race, power, politics, ecological disasters, it's all there in very concentrated form. And I also just felt viscerally pretty comfortable there. He made more trips to Haiti, sometimes for a week, sometimes for 2 weeks. He made friends. He invited them to visit him in Dallas. You haven't lived until you've had a Haitian stay in your house, Fountain says. I mean, I was involved. I couldn't just walk away. This was a very non-rational, non-linear part of the whole process. I had a pretty specific time era that I was writing about and certain things that I needed to know. But there were other things I didn't really need to know. I met a fellow who was with Save the Children, and he was on the Central Plateau, which takes about 12 hours to get to on bus, and I had no reason to go there. But I went there. But I went up there, suffered on that bus, ate dust. It was a hard trip, but it was a glorious trip. It had nothing to do with the book, but it wasn't wasted knowledge. In Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, four of the stories are about Haiti, and they are the strongest in the collection. They feel like Haiti. They feel as if they've been written from the inside looking out, not the outside looking in. After the novel was done, I don't know, I just felt that there was more and I could keep going deeper there, Fountain recalls. Always there's something, always something here for me. How many times have I been? At least 30 times. Prodigies like Picasso, Galenson argues, rarely engage in that kind of open-ended exploration. They tend to be conceptual, Galenson says, in the sense that they start with a clear idea of where they want to go, and then they execute it. I can hardly understand the importance given to the word research, Picasso once said in an interview with the artist Marius Dezeus. In my opinion, to search means nothing in painting. To find is the thing. He continued, the several manners I have used in my art must not be considered as an evolution or as steps toward an unknown ideal of painting. I have never made trials or experiments. But late bloomers, Galenson says, tend to work the other way around. Their approach is experimental. Their goals are imprecise, so their procedure is tentative and incremental. Galenson writes in Old Masters and Young Geniuses. He goes on, the imprecision of their goals means that these artists rarely feel they have succeeded, and their careers are consequently often dominated by the pursuit of a single objective. These artists repeat themselves, painting the same subject many times and gradually changing its treatment in an experimental process of trial and error. Each work leads to the next, and none is generally privileged over the others, so experimental painters rarely make specific preparatory sketches or plans for a painting. They consider the production of a painting as a process of searching, in which they aim to discover the image in the course of making it. They typically believe that learning is a more important goal than making finished paintings. Experimental artists build their skills gradually over the course of their careers, improving their work slowly over long periods. These artists are perfectionists and are typically plagued by frustration at their inability to achieve their goal. Where Picasso wanted to find, not search, Cézanne said the opposite, I seek in painting. An experimental innovator would go back to Haiti 30 times. That's how that kind of mind figures out what it wants to do. When Cézanne was painting a portrait of the critic Gustave Geffroy, he made him endure 80 sittings over 3 months before he announced the project a failure. The result is one of that string of masterpieces in the Musée d'Orsay. When Cézanne painted his dealer, Ambroise Vollard, he made Vollard arrive at 8 in the morning and sit on a rickety platform until 11:30 without a break on 150 occasions before abandoning the portrait. He would paint a scene, then repaint it, then paint it again. He was notorious for slashing his canvases to pieces in fits of frustration. Mark Twain was the same way. Galenson quotes the literary critic Franklin Rogers on Twain's trial and error method. His routine procedure seems to have been to start a novel with some structural plan which ordinarily soon proved defective, whereupon he would cast about for a new plot which would overcome the difficulty, rewrite what he had already written, and then push on until some new defect forced him to repeat the process once again. Twain fiddled and despaired and revised and gave up on Huckleberry Finn so many times that the book took him nearly a decade to complete. The Saisons of the World bloom late not as a result of some defect in character or distraction or lack of ambition, but because the kind of creativity that proceeds through trial and error necessarily takes a long time to come to fruition. One of the best stories in Brief Encounters is called Near Extinct Birds of the Central Cordillera. It's about an ornithologist taken hostage by the FARC guerrillas of Colombia. Like so much of Fountain's work, it reads with an easy grace, but there was nothing easy or graceful about its creation. I struggled with that story, Fountain says. I always tried to do too much. I mean, I probably wrote 500 pages of it in various incarnations. Fountain is at work right now on a novel. It's supposed to come out this year. It's late. Galenson's idea that creativity can be divided into these types, conceptual and experimental, has a number of important implications. For example, we sometimes think of late bloomers as late starters. They don't realize they're good at something until they're 50, so of course they achieve late in life, but that's not quite right. Cézanne was painting almost as early as Picasso was. We also sometimes think of them as artists who are discovered late. The world is just slow to appreciate their gifts. In both cases, the assumption is that the prodigy and the late bloomer are fundamentally the same, and that the late blooming is simply genius under conditions of market failure. What Galenson's argument suggests is something else, that late bloomers bloom late because they simply aren't much good until late in their careers. All of these qualities of his inner vision were continually hampered and obstructed by Cézanne's incapacity to give sufficient vermisitude to the persona of his drama, the great English art critic Roger Fry wrote of the early Cézanne. With all his rare endowments, he happened to lack the comparatively common gift of illustration, the gift that any draughtsman for the illustrated papers learns in a school of commercial art. Whereas to realize such visions as Cézanne required this gift in high degree. In other words, the young Cézanne couldn't draw. Of The Banquet, which Cézanne painted at 31, Fry writes, "It's no use to deny that Cézanne has made a very poor job of it." Fry goes on, "More happily endowed with more integral personalities have been able to express themselves harmoniously from the very first. But such rich, complex, and conflicting natures as Cézanne's require a long period of fermentation." Cézanne was trying something so elusive that he couldn't master it until he spent decades practicing. This is the vexing lesson of Fountain's long attempt to get noticed by the literary world. On the road to great achievement, the late bloomer will resemble a failure. While the late bloomer is revising and despairing and changing course and slashing canvases to ribbons after months or years, what he or she produces will look like the kind of thing produced by the artist who will never bloom at all. Prodigies are easy. They advertise their genius from the get-go. Late bloomers are hard. They require forbearance and blind faith. Let's just be thankful that Cézanne didn't have a guidance counselor in high school who looked at his primitive sketches and told him to try accounting. Whenever we find a late bloomer, we can't but wonder how many others like him or her we have thwarted because we prematurely judged their talents. But we also have to accept that there's nothing we can do about it. How can we ever know which of these failures will end up blooming? Not long after meeting Ben Fountain, I went to see the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, the author of the 2002 bestseller Everything is Illuminated. Fountain is a graying man, slight and modest, who looks, in the words of a friend of his, like a golf pro from Augusta, Georgia. Foer is in his early 30s and looks barely old enough to drink. Fountain has a softness to him, as if his years of struggle have worn away whatever sharp edges he once had. Foer gives the impression that if you touched him while he was in full conversational flight, you would get an electric shock. "I came to writing really by the back door," Foer said. "My wife is a writer, and she grew up keeping journals. You know, parents said, lights out, time for bed, and she had a little flashlight under the covers reading books. I don't think I read a book until much later than other people. I just wasn't interested in it." Foer went to Princeton and took a creative writing class in his freshman year with Joyce Carol Oates. It was, he explains, sort of a whim, maybe out of a sense that I should have a diverse course load. He'd never written a story before. "I didn't really think anything of it, to be honest, but halfway through the semester, I arrived to class early one day and she said, 'Oh, I'm glad I have this chance to talk to you. I'm a fan of your writing.' And it was a real revelation for me." Oates told him that he had the most important of writerly qualities, which was energy. He had been writing 15 pages a week for that class, an entire story for each seminar. "Why does a dam with a crack in it leak so much?" he said with a laugh. "There was just something in me. There was like a pressure." As a sophomore, he took another creative writing class. During the following summer, he went to Europe. He wanted to find the village in Ukraine where his grandfather had come from. After the trip, he went to Prague. There he read Kafka as any literary undergraduate would, and sat down at his computer. "I was just writing," he said. I didn't know that I was writing until it was happening. I didn't go with the intention of writing a book. I wrote 300 pages in 10 weeks. I really wrote. I've never done it like that." It was a novel about a boy named Jonathan Safran Foer who visits the village in Ukraine where his grandfather had come from. Those 300 pages were the first draft of Everything is Illuminated, the exquisite and extraordinary novel that established Foer as one of the most distinctive literary voices of his generation. He was 19 years old. Foer began to talk about the other way of writing books, where you painstakingly honed your craft over years and years. "I couldn't do that," he said. He seemed puzzled by it. It was clear that he had no understanding of how being an experimental innovator would work. I mean, imagine if the craft you're trying to learn is to be an original. How could you learn the craft of being an original? He began to describe his visit to Ukraine. "I went to the chateau where my family came from. It's called Trakimbrod, the name I use in the book. It's a real place, but you know what's funny? It's the single piece of research that made its way into the book." He wrote the first sentence, and he was proud of it, and then he went back and forth in his mind about where to go next. "I spent the first week just having this debate with myself about what to do with the first sentence. And once I made that decision, I felt liberated to just create, and it was very explosive after that." If you read Everything is Illuminated, you end up with the same feeling you get when you read Brief Encounters of Che Guevara, the sense of transport you experience when a work of literature draws you into its own world. Both are works of art. It's just that, as artists, Fountain and Foer could not be less alike. Fountain went to Haiti 30 times. Foer went to Trakimbrod just once. "I mean, it was nothing," Foer said. "I had absolutely no experience there at all. It was just a springboard for my book. It was like an empty swimming pool that had to be filled up." Total time spent getting inspiration for his novel, 3 days. Ben Fountain did not make the decision to quit law and become a writer all by himself. He is married and has a family. He met his wife, Sharon, when they were both in law school at Duke. When he was doing real estate work at Akin & Gump, she was on the partner track in the tax practice at Thompson & Knight. The two actually worked in the same building in downtown Dallas. They got married in 1986 and had a son in April of 1987. Sherry, as Fountain calls her, took 4 months of maternity leave before returning to work. She made partner by the end of that year. We had our son in daycare downtown, she recalls. We would drive in together. One of us would take him to daycare. The other would go to work. One of us would pick him up. And then somewhere around 8 o'clock at night, we would have him bathed in bed. And then we hadn't eaten yet. And we'd be looking at each other going, this is just the beginning. She made a face. That went on for maybe a month or two. And Ben's like, I don't know how people do this. We both agreed that continuing at that pace was probably going to make us all miserable. Ben said to me, do you want to stay home? Stay home. Well, I was pretty happy at my job and he wasn't, so as far as I was concerned, it didn't make any sense for me to stay at home, and I didn't have anything besides practicing law that I really wanted to do, and he did. So I said, look, we can do this in a way that we can still have some daycare and you can write. And so we did that. Ben could start writing at 7:30 in the morning because Sherry took their son to daycare. He stopped working in the afternoon because that's when he had to pick him up. And then he did the shopping and the household chores. In 1989, they had a second child, a daughter. Fountain was full-fledged North Dallas stay-at-home dad. When Ben did this, we talked about the fact that it might not work, and we talked about generally, when will we know that this really isn't working? And I'd say, we'll give it 10 years, Sherry recalled. To her, 10 years didn't seem unreasonable. It takes a while to decide whether you like something or not, she says. And when 10 years became 12, and then 14, and then 16, and the kids were off in high school, she stood by him because even during that long stretch when Ben had published nothing at all, she was confident that he was getting better. She was fine with the trips to Haiti, too. I can't imagine writing a novel about a place you haven't at least tried to visit, she says. She even went with him once, and on their way into town from the airport, there were people burning tires in the middle of the road. I was making pretty decent money, and we didn't need two incomes, Sherry went on. She has a calm, unflappable quality about her. I mean, it would have been nice, but we could live on one. Sherry was Ben's wife, but she was also, to borrow a term from long ago, his patron. That word has a condescending edge to it today because we think of it far more appropriate for artists, and everyone else for that matter, to be supported by the marketplace. But the marketplace only works for people like Jonathan Safran Foer, whose art emerges fully realized at the beginning of their career. Or Picasso, whose talent was so blindingly obvious that an art dealer offered him 150 francs a month stipend the minute he got to Paris at age 20. If you are the type of creative mind that starts without a plan and has to experiment and learn by doing, you need someone to see you through the long and difficult time it takes for your art to reach its true level. This is what is so instructive about any biography of Cézanne. Accounts of his life start out being about Cézanne, then quickly turn into the story of Cézanne's circle. First and foremost is always his best friend from childhood, the writer Émile Zola, who convinces the awkward misfit from the provinces to come to Paris, and who serves as his guardian and protector and coach through the long, lean years. Here is Zola, already in Paris, in a letter to the young Cézanne back in Provence. Note the tone, more parental than fraternal. You ask me an odd question. Of course one can work here as anywhere else, if one has the will. Paris offers further an advantage you can't find elsewhere, the museums in which you can study the old masters from 11 to 4. This is how you must divide your time. From 6 to 11, you go to a studio to paint from a live model. You have lunch, then from 12 to 4, you copy, in the Louvre or the Luxembourg, whatever masterpiece you like. That will make up 9 hours of work. I think that ought to be enough. Zola goes on, detailing exactly how Cézanne could manage financially on a month stipend of 125 francs. I'll reckon you out for what you should spend. A room at 20 francs a month, lunch at 18 sous, and dinner at 22, which makes 2 francs a day or 60 francs a month. Then you have the studio to pay for. The Atelier Sous, one of the least expensive, charges, I think, 10 francs. Add 10 francs for canvases, canvas, brush, colors, that makes 100. So you'll have 25 francs left for laundry, light, the thousand little needs that turn up. Camille Pissarro was the next critical figure in Cézanne's life. It was Pissarro who took Cézanne under his wing and taught him how to be a painter. For years, there would be periods in which they went off into the country and worked side by side. Then there was Ambrose Vollard, the sponsor of Cézanne's first one-man show at the age of 51. At the urging of Pissarro, Renoir, Degas, and Monet, Vollard hunted down Cézanne in Aix. He spotted a still life in a tree where it had been flung by Cézanne in disgust. He poked around the town, putting the word out that he was in the market for Cézanne's canvases. In Lost Earth, A Life of Cézanne, a biographer of Philip Callot writes about what happened next. Before long, someone appeared at his hotel with an object wrapped in a cloth. He sold the picture for 150 francs, which inspired him to trot back to his house with the dealer to inspect several more magnificent Cézannes. Vollard paid 1,000 francs for the job lot, then went on the way out and was nearly hit on the head by a canvas that had been overlooked, dropped out of the window by the man's wife. All of the pictures had been gathering dust, half buried in a pile of junk in the attic. All this came before Vollard agreed to sit 150 times from 8 in the morning to 11:30 without a break for a picture that Cézanne disgustedly abandoned. Once, Vollard recounted in his memoir, he fell asleep and toppled off the makeshift platform. Cézanne berated him, incest. Does the apple move? This is called friendship. Finally, there was Cézanne's father, the banker Louis Auguste. From the time Cézanne first left Aix at the age of 22, Louis Auguste paid his bills. Even when Cézanne gave every indication of being nothing more than a failed dilettante. But for Zola, Cézanne would have remained an unhappy banker's son in province. But for Pissarro, he would never have learned how to paint. But for Vollard, at the urging of Pissarro, Renoir, Degas, and Monet, his canvases would have rotted away in some attic. And, but for his father, Cézanne's long apprenticeship would have been a financial impossibility. That is an extraordinary list of patrons. The first three, Zola, Pissarro, and Vollard, would have been famous even if Cézanne never existed, and the fourth was an unusually gifted entrepreneur who left Cézanne 400,000 francs when he died. Cézanne didn't just have help. He had a dream team in his corner. This is the final lesson of the late bloomer. His or her success is highly contingent on the efforts of others. In biographies of Cézanne, Louis Auguste invariably comes across as a kind of grumpy Philistine who didn't appreciate his son's genius. But Louis Auguste didn't have to support Cézanne all those years. He would have been well within his rights to make his son get a real job, just as Sherry might well have said no to her husband's repeated trips to the chaos of Haiti. She could have argued that she had some right to the lifestyle of her profession and status, that she deserved to drive a BMW, which is what power couples in North Dallas drive, instead of a Honda Accord, which is what she settled for. But she believed in her husband's art, or perhaps more simply, she believed in her husband, the same way Zola and Pissarro and Vollard, and in his own generous way, Louis Auguste, must have believed in Cézanne. Late bloomers' stories are invariably love stories, and this may be why we have such difficulty with them. We like to think that mundane matters like loyalty, steadfastness, and the willingness to keep writing checks to support what looks like failure have nothing to do with something as rarefied as genius. But sometimes genius is anything but rarefied. Sometimes it's just the thing that emerges after 20 years of working at your kitchen table. Sherry never brought up money, not once, never, Fountain says. She was sitting next to him, and he looked over at her in a way that made it plain that he understood how much credit for brief encounters belonged to his wife. Her eyes welled up with tears. I never felt any pressure from her, he said, not even covert, not even implied. I was introduced to this article by my friend Ashley, who has been on the show a couple times in the past. I think just once. I think we tried to have her on again, and life is busy. I had heard about this, but I had not read about it, and I find this article encouraging. Not all those who wander are lost, and also a bit cathartic, this idea that there's different methods that people use to get where they're going, and sometimes the plan is clear from the get-go, and sometimes it's a very wandering course, which I feel happens when people tell you about finding their place in the world, that I can't tell you how many times someone has told me something to the effect of, if you had asked me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 3 years ago, if this was, like, where I would be, that I could never have even imagined being where I am. And I feel like that's hopeful, because it creates space for possibility, potential, and growth in unexpected ways. And that also the things that you want or pursuing can also change in unexpected ways, and that you don't always have to know in the moment what you're doing. For example, why you're traveling to Haiti. And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. I asked Ashley if I could read an article that she wrote about this, and she said yes. Ashley has a wonderful blog that she just launched. Please visit it. It's ashsanders.com, ashsanders.com. And Ash is one of the most incredible people I've ever met. Her articles have the same vibrancy that her person does. She says, let's hear it for the late bloomers. Grace Paley had a gaggle of kids and a million friends. And that was my dog who's helping me record, because she's very helpful. All right, let's try that again. Take two. Let's hear it for the late bloomers. Grace Paley had a gaggle of kids and a million friends and wars to end, so she wrote on scraps of paper anytime she had some peace. I, on the other hand, have written very little. I always meant to write, but then I'd do something else instead. I meant to write when I went to college, but then I spent my time planning elaborate costume parties. I meant to write after college, but then I became a full-fledged activist, rushing around trying to save the climate or democracy or whatever else needed saving. When I burned out on that, I was consumed with the process of leaving Mormonism, which took many agonizing years. Then I had a surprise baby, followed by an adoption, and then my friend died, and then, and then, and then. By the time I was 34, I had begun to despair. If I hadn't written by then, maybe I wasn't a writer after all. I would wake up at night and stare at the ceiling, thinking about aging and dashed dreams and the general idea of hurling toward death. I scoffed at myself for thinking I was any different than anyone else. I had thought my dreams were so special, so sure to come true. Was this how everyone gave up on themselves? A slow leaking of self after 30? I was despaired because I had seen the lists. The hottest writers under 35, 30 under 30. I knew about Mozart and his symphonies at the age of 6. This was what it meant to be legit, to be young and full of an impressionable skill, a genius. And I was old and easily repressible. And that was hard, because if I had to be embarrassingly honest with myself, I had grown up thinking that I would be one of those people, one of those 30 under 30, someone who wowed the world hard and early, and yet here I was, too old for the lists, and I hadn't even started. So I took a class, Fiction Sprints, it was called. The class was for people who wanted to write but couldn't. In the Wednesday class, this category included 8 people, moms with unwritten memoirs, and sensible-looking accountants with a knack for dystopia, punks with paint splatter jeans, and a woman with a story about oversexed foxes. And me. The teacher surveyed us and asked a simple question. Who here would call themselves a writer? And no one's hand went up. Why aren't you writers? We all looked at him like he was stupid. Because we don't write, said one woman. Duh. My teacher felt differently. He thought it was possible to be a writer even if you don't write much. Maybe you haven't written the thing, the piece you want to write, he said. But do you write in your journals? Do you think about writing? I wrote in my journal all the time, but it was my way to avoid real writing, so I never counted it. I hadn't written the thing. I wasn't precocious fount of many blessings. Ergo, I was not a writer. So my teacher set out to fix that. We would write every day by hand in paper journals, 30 minutes without stopping. We would record the weather every day to get us observing, to get us searching for a pen. We would write little goals on note cards, pathetically small goals that made me turn my nose up. And we would write together without speaking or checking our phones. I was terrified of the handwriting, especially. My handwriting looked like someone had dropped a string of yarn on the ground. I never wrote on paper. I wrote on the computer. But I sat down at my table and began to begin. I decided I would write a novel. I stared at my notebook, and then I moved to my bed. Everyone I knew had quit, and they had questions. What's your novel about? How long until you get a job? I didn't know what I was writing about, but weird ideas were beginning to converge. Mountaintop removal and climate grief and free diving, I said. Loss. Oh, and dead babies. That cleared the room, which left me more time to write. And a strange thing began happening. I was writing. Shitty writing. Lousy writing. Writing that smelled to high heaven, but writing. Something about writing by hand freed me up. It unstuck something. I can just burn all of this if I don't like it, I thought, with a pyrotechnic gleam in my eye. No one ever has to know, and this anonymity put me 30 pages in. I was writing a book about a woman fighting mountaintop removal in West Virginia, a woman who doesn't want to have a baby, hashtag because climate change, but who does, eventually, as an act of faith in the future. A woman whose baby dies being born, a woman who stops believing in a future, a woman whose grief drives her out of West Virginia and into the ocean where she becomes a free diver, searching for her daughter in the deep, a daughter that in the woman's grief becomes a fish. It was a book about amphibiousness, about life crawling out of the ocean billions of years ago, just to sink back into it in the 21st century. This time via rising seas. It was a novel about grief, the kind of global grief that has nothing and everything to do with a single person. It was about the kinds of grief I had felt many, many, many times and many times over. There was one problem. I had never been to West Virginia. I knew nothing, next to nothing about mountaintop removal, and I had never been free diving, and in fact was terrified of the deep ocean. I didn't know the science behind climate change or the names of marine animals. I didn't know the grief of a person who gave birth to a dead baby or how it felt to live in a coal town all my life. I just had these images, a picture I saw once, an aerial shot of West Virginia, the mountains blackened and gone, a free diver in azure blue water, curled into the fetal position, being carried in an arcing current through the deep. The image of a child falling out of me. The feeling for a brief, terrifying second, what if she is dead? I didn't know where these images came from or why they wanted to be together. When I collected these images, I had no idea that they would be useful to me later. At the time, I simply thought, I'm a failure. I'm not writing. Picasso famously said he'd never researched his paintings. He simply found them on canvas. Mozart said something infuriating about writing a symphony was like apples falling from trees. It just wanted to happen. I, however, was not working with apples. After 30 pages, I stopped petrified. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know anything. How could I write about West Virginia without knowing everything about it? How could I write about anything without knowing everything about it? I know about Picasso's famous line because I read Malcolm Gladwell's piece, Late Bloomers, in The New Yorker. I found the article when I thought I was time-wasting, but as so often happens, my time was not wasted. Instead, that article has saved me many times, has bolstered my resolve and quieted my fears, has stopped me mid-doom spiral. That's because the article is partly about how it's okay to be old and to be an old artist. Gladwell is interested in puncturing a persistent social myth that the only true kind of genius is precocity, an organic, early sprouting flower, blooming from the head of a six-year-old, a 20-year-old, a person who says, "Oh, this old novel symphony painting? It came to me whole. I finished it in a day." Gladwell is trying to make the case for late-blooming genius, a flower that feeds off decomposing years and raises its fermented head at the dead end of summer. To do this, he compares precocious Picasso and slow-learning Cézanne. Jonathan Safran Foer, kid genius, and Ben Fountain, who, like me, quit his law job and also started writing a novel, and who freaked out and took years to finish it. First things first, I'm not calling myself a genius here. Remember, most days I can barely call myself a writer. But I am an opportunist, and I will take relief where I can get it, and I relate to Gladwell's description of Fountain's first week on the job. The first day Ben Fountain sat down to write at his kitchen table went well. He knew how the story about the stockbroker was supposed to start, but the second day he completely freaked out. He didn't know how to describe things. He felt as if he were back in first grade. He didn't have a fully formed vision waiting to be emptied onto the page. I had to create a mental image of a building, a room, a facade, haircut, clothes, just really basic things, he says. I realized I didn't have the faculty to put those into words. Pretty much, Safran Foer, on the other hand, took a couple creative writing courses for funsies, visited his Jewish grandparents' birthplace for a minute or two, and then wrote a fully formed novel in the blink of an eye. So Safran Foer is precocious. Fountain is a late bloomer. So is Cézanne. Or, as one writer put it, with all his rare endowments, he happened to lack the comparatively common gift of illustration, the gift that any draughtsman for the illustrated papers learns in a school of commercial art. More happily endowed and more integral personalities have been able to express themselves harmoniously from the very first, but such rich and complex and conflicting natures as Cézanne's require a long period of fermentation. Here are some other differences. Prodigies tend to be conceptual. They don't ruminate or research. Or, as precocity spokesperson Picasso says, "The several manners I have used in my art must not be considered as an evolution or steps toward the unknown ideal of painting. I have never made trials or experiments." Late bloomers like Fountain and Cézanne, on the other hand, tend to seek in their work. They make dozens of tries, endless experiments. In Fountain's case, he realized he had collected a stack of articles about the country Haiti, and then a light went off. His book was about Haiti. But what about Haiti? He didn't know. He went there dozens of times, wandering and meeting people and probably wondering if he was wasting his time. In the end, he wrote Brief Encounters with Che Guevara, crammed with chapters and scenes set in Haiti. And a lot of his research had, as Fountain says, nothing to do with the book, but wasn't wasted knowledge. The idea that writing can be seeking, that experiments and failures can be part of the finished product, and that even the lost parts weren't wasted. I want to tattoo that on my forehead. Let's see, what else? Late bloomers tend to be perfectionists. Their goals, according to creativity expert Galenson, are imprecise, so their procedure is tentative and incremental. It's not because they're distracted or lack ambition, but because the kind of creativity that proceeds through trial and error necessarily takes a long time to come to fruition. And finally, they have patrons. Yep, you heard me. Patrons. Not necessarily members of the Medici family, but people who rally around them, who give them support, emotional, financial, physical, and who keep them on the path. Ben Fountain's wife pushed him to finish his books, made space for him to create by giving him the time, financial support, and encouragement he needed. She wanted to be a lawyer, so she worked and let him be a writer. Cézanne had friends too, friends who pushed him to move to Paris, who dug his paintings out of the attic and showed them to gallerists, who supported him financially when he learned finally to draw. What's my point? My point is that for many years, I believed that since I didn't come out writing with full stories uncurling in my head because I waited so long to start that I had wasted my time, squandered it, that I wasn't really a writer. And of course, ultimately, if you want to write, you have to write. And I will have to as well. The reason this article is important to me is that it takes apart a very damaging social myth that to be creative, you have to be young. You have to know yourself and your ideas immediately and perfectly, and that you have to devastate everyone with your talent early and often. It allows me to think that maybe I didn't write this novel 15 years ago because I wasn't ready, because I had to experiment and wander and research and gain basic perspective and skill before I could begin, that I needed experience and material support before I could begin. And maybe, of course, this is all an excuse. Maybe I could have written earlier. Maybe I should have. But I'm writing now, and guys, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. Every day I wake up, and it's just me and my pajamas fighting the idea that it's too late. Fighting the idea that I'm too old. Fighting the idea that I'm so far from where I want to be. Or that there's some secret memo about how to do everything that I didn't get. And so I scavenge from Gladwell's essay for breakfast. I eat up the possibility of these words. Prodigies are easy. They advertise their genius from the get-go. Late bloomers are hard. They require forbearance and blind faith. I'm trying to have some faith and a Costco-sized amount of forbearance. Mostly I'm trying to take my time and believe in Fountain's belief that time, even time spent badly or despairingly with no real objective in mind, is not wasted. And to believe in the mundanity of the task, the doing and the doing again. The fear that my words are old or canned or nothing special, the dogged boredom of slogging toward an idea, a hazy picture of my words, of a book, my life. Because as Gladwell says, sometimes genius is anything but rarefied. Sometimes it's just the thing that emerges after 20 years of working at your kitchen table. You just tuned in. You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you are enjoying anything here today, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can email me at inkandworm@gmail.com. All lowercase, all spelled out, inkandworm@gmail.com. Also, make sure you check out Radio Free Brooklyn and join the community there. Always lots of fun things happening. I want to end with a quick story that I found in Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Big Magic. And she talks about Winifred, whom she knew in the 90s in Greenwich Village. She goes on, I first met her at her 90th birthday party, which was quite a wild bash. Winifred was the most vividly alive woman I had ever met in my young life. So one day, looking for inspiration, I asked her, what's the best book you've ever read? She said, oh, darling, I could never narrow it down to just one book because so many books are important to me, but I can tell you that my favorite subject. 10 years ago, I began studying the history of ancient Mesopotamia, and it became my passion, and let me tell you, it has totally changed my life. For me, at the age of 25, to hear a 90-year-old widow speak of having her life changed by passion, and so recently, was a revelation. But as I learned more about Winifred's passion, what struck me was that she was now an acknowledged expert in the history of ancient Mesopotamia. She had given that field of study an entire decade of her life, after all, and if you devote yourself to anything diligently for 10 years, that will make you an expert. That's the time it would take to earn 2 master's degrees and a doctorate. She had gone to the Middle East on several archaeological digs. She had learned cuneiform script. She was friendly, was the greatest scholars and curators on the subject, and she had never missed a related museum exhibit or lecture when it came to the town. People now sought out Winifred for answers about ancient Mesopotamia because she is now an authority. You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for listening, and I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Inflorescence.